the Heising-Simons Foundation. Stay with us for the next hour of Forum. First, though, traffic. Joe Salvatore is back, and we're looking at the Dumbarton Bridge this time.
Yes, Andy, this is eastbound on the high rise there. It's a stall. It is blocking the two right lanes, and so traffic is slow as cars approach the scene there. The other problem we have is just clearing up in San Jose, southbound 880 at Stevens Creek Boulevard. It was a stall that was blocking the right lane. They have moved that over to the shoulder. I'm Joe Salvatore for KQED.
Thank you, Joe. See you next hour. Traffic support comes from Murphy Mechanic Construction. And support for KQED comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is KQED-FM San Francisco and KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento. Good evening. I'm Sandy Althaus. The time, 9 p.m.
From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. All of Gaza's more than 2 million residents are facing acute levels of hunger or worse, according to the Food Security Information Network. In Sudan, the vulnerable are also beginning to die of starvation, as some 20 million face severe food insecurity. Extreme hunger has both immediate and, according to my guest, Tessa Roseboom, very long-term consequences. Roseboom's research on Dutch children born during famine at the end of World War II finds the impact of starvation can last generations. We look at what the research tells us about how we can and must respond to conflict-driven hunger around the world.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Shay Stevens. The prosecution has rested its case in the criminal fraud trial of Donald Trump in New York. Former attorney Michael Cohen claims he paid hush money to a porn star days before the 2016 election at the direction of Trump. But NPR's Andrea Bernstein reports that Monday's courtroom drama focused on the judge and a defense witness who is a former Cohen attorney.
At one point in the questioning of the lawyer, Robert Costello, Costello said audibly after Judge Juan Merchan had sustained an objection, "Geez," and Judge Merchan said, "Excuse me?" And Costello said, "Strike it, strike it." Then the judge sent the jury out of the room and said, "You don't give me the side eye. You don't roll your eyes. Are you staring me down now?" At which point he cleared the courtroom before questioning resumed.
NPR's Andrew Bernstein in New York. Sparks flew at a public meeting by the Texas Medical Board Monday. As NPR Selena Simmons-Duffin reports, the board is supposed to clarify exceptions to the abortion ban in Texas.
Over nearly 5 hours, many people expressed concerns that the state's medical exception is still very unclear. One of those who spoke was Kate Cox, who last year went to court while pregnant facing a serious complication. She sought permission to receive an abortion in Texas and was denied.
I asked my state for help, but the Texas Supreme Court's decision didn't help me. Instead, the court pointed me to this board, the Texas Medical Board. I'm afraid the rules this board are now proposing wouldn't have helped me either.
In the meeting, the board members sometimes defended their wording and process, but also seemed open to clarifying some aspects of the rules. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
The United States has expressed condolences to Iran in wake of the helicopter crash that killed the country's president and foreign minister. NPR's Michelle Kellen reports that the U.S. was also willing to help in the recovery efforts at the site, but didn't do so for logistical reasons.
In the aftermath of the crash, Iran asked the U.S. for help, according to State Department spokesman Matthew Miller.
We were asked by the Iranian government for assistance. We said that we would be willing to assist. It's something that we would do with respect to any government in this situation. Ultimately, largely for logistical reasons, we weren't able to provide that assistance.
He wouldn't give any other details about the contacts the U.S. had with Iran over the crash. Miller put out a statement offering, quote, official condolences to Iran, though he noted the late Iranian president had a decades-long record of human rights abuses. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The chief prosecutor at the International Criminal Court is seeking arrest warrants for the leaders of Israel and Hamas. Karim Khan alleges Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and Hamas leaders have committed war crimes and crimes against humanity. This is NPR News. The gunman in the 2021 mass shooting at Michigan's Oxford High School is seeking an appeal. Ethan Crumbly is serving life in prison for murdering four people and injuring seven others when he was 15. His attorneys are seeking sentencing reports from the case against Crumbly's parents. James and Jennifer Crumbly each received 10 to 15-year prison terms for ignoring their son's mental health issues and buying him a gun. They are also appealing. The ship that knocked down Baltimore's Key Bridge is back in port nearly 2 months after the disaster. Crews finished refloating the dolly early Monday, as Matt Bush reports from member station WYPR.
It took just a few hours for tugboats to escort the nearly 1,000-foot ship, with thousands of cargo containers still stacked on its deck, back to port at 1 mile per hour. The crew of the dolly remains on the ship just as they have since the crash almost 8 weeks ago. It's the latest step in getting the Port of Baltimore fully reopened for shipping since the ship struck a support pier of the Key Bridge on the morning of March 26th. Six construction workers patching potholes on the bridge at the time were killed. Officials hope to have the port fully reopened at the end of the month. For NPR News, I'm Matt Bush in Baltimore.
The chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation will step down from the post once a successor is appointed. The White House says that President Biden will name a replacement for Morton Broomberg soon and called for the Senate to quickly confirm that individual's nomination. I'm Shay Stevens. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Angie, dedicated to helping homeowners find skilled pros to get their home projects done well, from everyday repairs to dream remodels. Reviews, pricing, and booking are at Angie.com or on the Angie app. This is NPR.
Sunshine tomorrow around the bay, with highs from the low 60s at the ocean to the mid-80s inland. 83 for the high in Livermore tomorrow, Half Moon Bay 63. San Carlos expecting 76 and 72 for San Francisco.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. In the final 6 months of World War II, parts of the Netherlands experienced catastrophic hunger as Germany's occupying forces blocked food from entering the region. 50 years later, Tessa Roseboom began studying the long-term impacts of this period of starvation on Dutch survivors and their offspring, finding that the consequences of malnutrition can last multiple generations. In this hour, we take a closer look at Roseboom's findings, what they teach us about the long-term effects of starvation, and what can be done to mitigate its worst impacts as hundreds of millions experience acute hunger across the globe. Dr. Tessa Roseboom is Professor of Early Development and Health at the University of Amsterdam. Dr. Roseboom, welcome to Forum.
Thank you so much.
This period of starvation, it was called the Dutch Hunger Winter, and it went from November 1944 to May of 1945. Can you tell us what happened, how it started?
Yeah. So the Dutch famine was a period of acute starvation during the last few months of the Second World War. And while the food had been rationed during the entire Second World War, food rations were around 18 to 2,000 calories a day. They suddenly dropped really dramatically when the German occupying forces had banned all food transport. And this was in response to a series of events when the Allied forces had landed in Normandy and they had liberated France and Belgium. And in their upward movement to the north, they encountered some challenges. Operation Market Garden failed, and the Dutch government in exile called for a railway strike to support the Allied offensive to the north. And then the Germans retaliated by banning all food transport. So suddenly the rations that were around 2,000 calories a day dropped really dramatically to around 400 to 800 calories a day. And that really lasted until the Netherlands was liberated in the first week of May of 1945.
And you were really focused on how this impacted particularly pregnant mothers at the time. What did you find?
Well, we found quite striking effects of exposure to this period of famine on the unborn babies that really depended on the timing of the famine occurring early, in the middle, or at the end of pregnancy. Mm. And we saw that these effects lasted for decades, because when we started studying these individuals at the age of 50, we could still clearly see effects. For instance, babies who had been conceived around the time of the famine, and so all the organs and tissues that you develop just after conception were affected by the fact that there was very little food, and therefore the building blocks that they received to build the organs and tissues that last a lifetime were in general smaller. They had a different structure, and that really affected their lifelong function.
So in terms of smaller, one of the things that you found were smaller brains. Can you talk about this and how it affected cognitive abilities?
Exactly. Well, we made MRI scans of the brains of these hunger winter babies that were now in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. And we saw that their brains were not only smaller in size, but the blood perfusion was also different in the brain. And their brains responded differently to different stimuli. So when we asked people to do all sorts of cognitive tests in the MRI scanner, we saw that their brain activity was different. And this resulted in poorer cognitive function, so poorer performance on several cognitive tasks. But it also led to lower participation on the labor market, for instance, as well as increased responses to stress and increased rates of anxiety and depression disorders.
Hmm. So it really had a ripple effect. What were the impacts on stress?
Well, when we tested people's stress responsiveness, we invited them to come to the clinic to go a really detailed series of stress tests, in which we initially assessed their stress system, their blood pressure, their stress hormone levels in rest. And then we exposed them to different stressors. And what I found was really striking is that in rest, there were no big differences between people who had or had not been exposed to the Dutch famine. But when we exposed them to all sorts of different stressors, for instance, when we asked them to do a word color conflict task, or when we asked them to do a mirror drawing task, or to do a public speech task, we saw that their blood pressure and their heart rate went up much more dramatically than people who had not been exposed to famine. And this to us really suggests that also in everyday life, when you experience all sorts of stress, people would respond to those stressors with a stronger increase in blood pressure and heart rate. And that contributed to their increased risk of cardiovascular disease.
So this cohort, you began studying the Dutch famine and its impacts about 50 years later. So can you just tell us a little bit more about the demographics of this cohort that you studied? You said you studied them at different stages of birth, depending on, you know, when during the famine they were born and so on. Can you just give us a little bit more of a picture of this group of people?
Absolutely. We used birth records that have been kept in one particular hospital in Amsterdam, the Wilhelmina Gasthuis, which was one of the main teaching hospitals at the time. And unlike most medical records that are destroyed after decades, these birth records had been kept in the attic of the obstetrics department. And we used those records to trace people who were born at the time of the famine. And after tracing all these men and women who had been born around the time of the Dutch famine between November 1943 and February 47, so this included not only babies who had been exposed to famine in utero, but also babies born in the same hospital just before the famine started or after the famine had ended, so that we had two control groups, if you like. And these people were all born in Amsterdam, but they had spread to different parts of the country and abroad. And we traced all of them and invited them to come to the clinic to investigate their health. And we compared babies who'd been exposed to famine while they were inside their mother's womb to the babies who were born before the famine or conceived after it. And because the famine lasted 5 or 6 months, none of the babies had been exposed to the Dutch famine during the entire pregnancy. And that allowed us to distinguish between those who were exposed to the famine mainly in the beginning of pregnancy, or particularly in the middle of pregnancy, or at the end of pregnancy.
Tessa, and these groups were, yes,
sorry.
No, no, please finish.
And these groups were different in a sense that babies who were born during the famine and who therefore had been exposed to the famine at the end of pregnancy, they were, I mean, from birth on, it was clear that they had been exposed because they were smaller, thinner, lighter at birth. And that was not the case for babies who had been conceived during the famine, because the famine lasted not an entire pregnancy, but 5 or 6 months. So if babies had been conceived during the famine at the end of pregnancy, food rations were restored. And you could easily also see that in the weight gain that pregnant women experienced and that were recorded in our medical records. So we saw that these babies had a normal size at birth. So based on their size at birth, we initially didn't think that these babies were victims of famine, so to say. But when we actually studied them as adults, they were the ones who were more obese, had higher cholesterol levels, had higher risks of cardiovascular disease, but also different types of cancer. They were the ones who had the smaller brains. So this was an interesting lesson that we learned, that even if the size of the baby at birth is normal, it still suffers the consequences of this full starting life that they made and the lack of nutrients that they got to actually build the organs and tissues that last a lifetime.
We're talking with Dr. Tessa Roseboom, professor of early development and health at the University of Amsterdam, Netherlands. And you, our listeners, are invited to join the conversation. What questions do you have about the intergenerational effects of starvation? Have you or your family been affected by hunger or food shortage? Have you noticed any long-term effects? You can email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels at KQED Forum. You can call us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Tessa, I understand your parents were born in this famine period, but their experience may have been slightly different. We're coming up on a break, but do tell me, what was their experience like? Was that what inspired you to do this?
Well, actually, both of my parents indeed were exposed to the Dutch famine. My father was born just before the famine had started, so he was exposed to the famine as an infant. And my mother was exposed to famine in utero during the middle of pregnancy. And I don't think it really inspired me to do the studies because I was worried about their own health, but it did give me a very rich look into both the scientific aspect of the study, as well as being able to interview both my grandmothers about what the experience was like to be pregnant or to deliver a baby during a war and during a famine. And that has been an incredible experience to me.
Yes, and the most startling thing they told you?
Well, one thing they told me, and my parents were both lucky in the sense that they were born not in Amsterdam, but in the rural part of the country. And my grandmother would tell me that people from Amsterdam would come and have very undernourished babies while my dad was not so thin.
Wow. Dr. Tessa Roseboom. For the break, more with Forum.
Support for KQED comes from Cora. Cora offers safety, support, and healing for those experiencing domestic violence in San Mateo County. Learn more at corasupport.org. That's C-O-R-A, support.org.
Americans say they're feeling bad, and it all starts with two weak presidential candidates. So what about third-party options?
Do I think Robert Kennedy could get 30% of the vote in this election? 100%.
Hi, I'm Philip Young, co-CEO of Commonwealth Club World Affairs. This week on our episode of On Shifting Ground, the co-founder of the Lincoln Project, on whether RFK will play spoiler in November. Tune in Monday night at 10 p.m. right here on KQED.
The announcers and technical staff of KQED Radio are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51 AFL-CIO.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking this hour about the long-term effects of starvation with Dr. Tessa Roseboom. Her studies involving children born to survivors of the Dutch famine provided the first direct evidence in humans that maternal nutrition can affect generations. Malnutrition can affect generations extremely negatively. And Dr. Roseboom is professor of early development and health at the University of Amsterdam. And you, our listeners, are joining the conversation, posting your questions about the intergenerational effects of starvation on our social channels, X, Instagram, our digital community on Discord, by calling us at 866-733-6786, by emailing forum at kqed.org. And this listener writes, as a teenager and into her early 20s, my mother lived in England throughout World War II and in the immediate aftermath of time when food was rationed. When she was able to eat all she wanted at age 24, she found she had grown 2 inches. Another consequence is that she eats faster than anyone I know. I asked her about it once and she said it's because she figured out if she was first on the food line at nursing school, ate her food fast, she could get on the back of the line after everyone else and get a second helping, having all the food she could possibly eat for decades, never changed her wartime eating ways. I want to bring into the conversation now Abby Maxman, president and CEO of Oxfam America, an NGO working to alleviate hunger worldwide. Abby, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you. Thanks, Mina.
As I listen to Dr. Roseboom describing the long-term effects of starvation, of course, one of the most visible examples of conflict-driven starvation, and of course, in the Dutch famine's case, it was also conflict-driven starvation, one of the most physical examples, of course, is Gaza. And I know that Oxfam is there. And I'm wondering if you could just give us a sense of what the situation is there with regard to the acute hunger crisis from Oxfam's point of view.
Well, thanks, Mina. Yeah, you know, conflict and insecurity is a great cause of the most acute food insecurity. It's a driver in countries and territories affecting 135 million people worldwide. And in Gaza, we are seeing a situation that we've been sounding the alarm on for months about the risk of famine, and we are experiencing it directly through our nearly 30 colleagues who are in Gaza, their families, and the stories and anecdotes of that we're hearing daily that's happening to everybody living in the Gaza Strip affected by this conflict. We have done studies ourselves even recently where we calculated that just earlier this year, people in the north of Gaza were living on 245 calories a day. And as we also analyzed the volume of food that had been coming into the Strip since October through last month, that a 41% of the caloric needs of the entire population could even be met with what was coming in. So we have been sounding the alarm, and action needs to be taken immediately to reverse this terrible trajectory.
You have seen so many
hunger crises in many parts of the world, but you have described the Gaza crisis as unprecedented. In what way?
Well, there's a number of factors that contribute to that. Certainly the speed, the ferocity that this has come on. Gaza is a tiny strip, very condensed with people. And we also, it's been 7 months or nearly eight, and they were not experiencing massive food insecurity before this crisis. And so the speed and the number of people affected in such a short time, the proportion of the population impacted by this crisis is truly unprecedented. In famines that we've seen over the past decades, in Somalia, for example, in 2011, by the time famine is actually declared, half of the people who end up dying in a famine had already died. That was 260,000 people total in that particular context. Mm-hmm. But this is conflict affected, and there's an immediate way to make a change. Palestinians in Gaza are facing mass starvation, and we have a moral duty to reverse that.
Clearly, trying to get food aid in is one way to try to mitigate the mass starvation. And can you just talk to us about the challenges of distribution that Oxfam is experiencing, the challenges of trying to get this relief to people?
Well, the principal cause of the rapid deterioration, sadly, is the government of Israel's severe restrictions on humanitarian assistance, basic services, and commercial activity. The obstruction and the destruction that we are seeing is huge. And so our staff, and not alone, not uniquely ours, all humanitarian workers face risks to their lives just by doing their basic jobs. So that is a huge impediment to our ability to scale up a response that's meaningful. At the same time, what we have been able to accomplish under such, under the bombs falling, has been nothing short, in my view, of heroic. We've reached more than 250,000 people with basic needs, but the needs are huge, they're vast, and it's not just food, it is water, it is sanitation. People are living with open air sewage and waste around them. They are displaced not once, not twice, but multiple times with nowhere to go. And we know that often when people face this acute food insecurity, food crisis on the verge of famine, they end up dying from diarrhea, from waterborne and water-washed diseases that weakens people's immunities at an incredible speed. So with the siege, with the lack of any basic services working, this is really, as we said earlier, an unprecedented disaster in terms of the high percentage of households, the sheer numbers of people facing catastrophic hunger since these measurements began.
Dr. Rosenblum, it must be hard to hear all this that Abby Maxman is describing, knowing what you know about the very lasting effect of hunger on generations, knowing what you know probably about so many conflict-driven hunger situations across the world.
Indeed, it's devastating, and the sheer numbers of people currently affected are not only the victims of the hunger, also those who have not even been born yet will experience the consequences of this conflict. So the number of victims is even bigger than we already think there are.
Dr. Rosenblum, you touched on this, but can you say a little bit more about the issues you found with organ function and metabolism?
Yeah, well, we found smaller organs such as the brain, which really limited cognitive ability, which increased people's susceptibility to mental health problems and reduced their chances on the labor market, increased their risk of addiction. But also we saw that these bodies and their metabolism was really set up for scarcity. So people have very efficient metabolism, which ended up being a very negative adaptation, because when food became plentiful again, they had an increased tendency to develop obesity, to then go on and develop type 2 diabetes. So it really impacted their physical and their mental health a lot.
Let me go to caller Albert in Rio Vista. Albert, you're on.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. This is a really interesting conversation and one that has concerned me for a long time. My question is, has Dr. Rosen in particular found any physiological relationship between prenatal and infant malnutrition, severe malnutrition or famine, and tendencies towards violence? Kind of the psychological tendencies of individuals towards violence. And it Albert, seems to me that would have a lot of,
Yeah, thank you. Let me put that to Dr. Roseboom. Any relationship that you've observed between malnutrition, prenatal or infant, and violent tendencies?
Well, we ourselves haven't investigated violent tendencies, but there are studies showing that people who were exposed to famine prenatally more often have antisocial personality disorders, which might increase people's tendency to be violent.
The length of time of exposure to malnutrition and then the length of time for some of the things that you did observe to become evident, have you been able to put your finger on that, Dr. Roseboom?
Well, as I was already alluding to a little bit when we spoke earlier, is that the acute effects of famine that we saw very quickly after the famine had ended in terms of babies being born small were not the only predictors of later life adversity. So even the children who seemed to be okay because the famine had ended well before they were born, they still suffered the consequences, which makes me so worried about the situation in Gaza and the increasing numbers of victims that we will be affected by the shortage of food and by the circumstances that they are developing in even before they're born. And our studies haven't only shown that these effects last a lifetime, but actually they might be partly transferred to the next generation as well.
Yes, I want to go next to caller Barbara in San Francisco, who is on the line with us. Barbara, go ahead.
Yes, I had heard that the very fine actress Audrey Hepburn, who was in the movie on Saturday night, A Roman Holiday, was a victim of that famine in the Netherlands. Is that correct?
That is indeed correct, yes.
She is skinny as a rail, just beautiful, beautiful woman she was.
I have heard her say several times in interviews that the fact that she experienced the Dutch famine as a young girl has inspired her to work, for instance, for UNICEF to try and prevent some of the consequences that she herself experienced and witnessed of undernutrition and hunger.
Well, Georgianne writes, as a pediatric nurse practitioner and lactation consultant, we know that good nutrition is critical to optimal infant and child development. I'm curious if there were any controls around what type of nutrition, breast milk or otherwise, these infants received after they were born. Dr. Roseboom?
Yes, well, during the famine, already back then, people realized that children needed to be protected. So The government did everything they could to try and keep the rations for newborns and infants as high as they possibly could. But obviously, still children were affected. First of all, as many women were so undernourished that they couldn't breastfeed, there was a stark reduction in breastfeeding levels simply because women weren't able to breastfeed anymore. And formula wasn't available, so many children drank some diluted cow's milk, which clearly is suboptimal. We know that the government tried to keep the rations around 1,000 calories for young children, but there was very little available. So I'm convinced that this wasn't the appropriate or optimal nutrition that these children should have had.
We're talking with Dr. Tessa Roseboom about the long-term effects of starvation. Dr. Roseboom has done studies involving children born during or shortly after the Dutch famine, and it has provided evidence that parental nutrition can affect the health of children and grandchildren, so for multiple generations. We're also talking with Abby Maxman, President and CEO of Oxfam America, which is working to alleviate hunger worldwide, and with you, our listeners. Email your questions or comments about the effects of malnutrition, starvation, extreme hunger. Tell us if you or your family have been affected by hunger or food shortages, or someone you know. Perhaps you're an aid worker. Have you supported relief efforts for famine-affected regions? What was your experience like? How would you like to see the global community respond to our global food and hunger crisis? You can email forum at kqed.org, call us at 866-733-6786. You can find us on our social channels at KQED Forum on X, Instagram, or our digital community on Discord. Abby Maxman, we've talked about Gaza, but of course it is just one of many hunger crises and conflict-driven hunger crises as well across the globe. A short time ago, we talked about the situation in Sudan. And as far as that situation goes, it's one of the most urgent hotspots where you have warring military generals sparking a civil war and potentially putting 20 million people at risk of acute food insecurity. What can you tell us about what Oxfam knows about the situation in Sudan, since I know you are not specifically on the ground there?
Well, thank you. And yes, these conflicts that we're seeing globally and their implication on nutrition, malnutrition, is massive and deeply worrying. And we are continuing to support those who have been forced to flee into South Sudan at the border of Sudan and South Sudan. And we are seeing exactly what you are describing, people crowded and overcrowded conditions and lack of access to basic food, clean water, sanitation, all of those basic needs. There's an overstretch globally in the resources needed to enable us to all mount the scale of response needed. And for us as well, it's so important when we talk about food and hunger to talk about these basics like clean water, hygiene materials, hygiene kits for women and more. And so we are focusing on some of these needs of water, sanitation, as well as complementing, you know, with others on ensuring food and access to food and nutrition. It's a terrible crisis and affecting, as you said, it's driven 7.5 million people from their homes, this particular conflict in Sudan, by the end of 2023, and they have few assets or savings, heavily dependent on host populations or assistance. So this also puts pressure not just on the people fleeing, but the people who are receiving them.
And I have also seen stats that estimates that essentially acute hunger is affecting more than 280 million people across 59 countries, and that this is an increase from of about 24 million. Can you just quickly, we have 30 seconds, just tell us, besides conflict, what else is driving this increase?
Well, thank you. Conflict, climate, and income and economic inequality. These are all factors affecting this hunger crisis. And in a world that has the ability to produce enough food for more than the global population, we know we must prevent this and be able to address global hunger at scale.
And we'll talk about that right after the break. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Coming up tomorrow on Forum, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. He's reported from war zones, humanitarian crises, and delved into our own nation's struggles with poverty, addiction, and homelessness. And yet in his new memoir, Chasing Hope, Kristof calls himself an optimist. Journalism, he says, is an act of hope. We'll talk to Kristof about what he's learned from the power of storytelling to make people care about issues both near and far. Listen to past Forum shows by going to Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search KQED Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Relief workers are warning that we are in the cusp of famine and potential mass death in several conflict zones, including in Gaza and Sudan. Already aid groups are seeing massive hunger and suffering from an extreme scarcity of food. And we are looking at how the hunger crisis is affecting people now and what it could subject generations to with Dr. Tessa Roseboom, professor of early development and health at the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands, and Abby Maxman, president and CEO of Oxfam America. And you, our listeners, are joining the conversation. What do you want to know about the intergenerational effects of starvation or your questions about the effects of prolonged malnutrition, hunger? Have you or your family or someone you know ever been affected by this? What impact do you feel like it had? Perhaps you are an aid worker or you've tried to provide relief efforts for famine-affected regions. What was that experience like? And do you think enough is being done to support famine survivors? Obviously, there is a long tail with regard to the impact. What do you think we need to better do and better understand about this? The email address, forum@kqed.org, our social channels at KQED Forum, our phone number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. This listener writes, I grew up in a Dutch enclave in southwestern Ontario, composed of post-war immigrants and their offspring. I recall my friend's grandmother who'd survived hunger winter as a very young girl descending into dementia. They had to store away all the tulip bulbs because she'd go out in her nightgown even on frosty mornings to dig up the nascent bulbs and try to eat them. She also cried whenever she saw a pile of potato peelings. This is another heartbreaking consequence of severe early childhood trauma. It lingers somewhere deep in the mind and soul and reappears decades later. Dr. Roseboom, we've talked about the intentional German blockade and retaliation for the Netherlands' support of the Allied effort to try to fight and free most of the Netherlands. But the other factor really was an incredibly harsh winter at the same time, right?
Absolutely, yes. It wasn't only the blockade of the food transport, but the famine occurred during a winter that started really early and froze all waterways. So that limited food transport even more. And because there was no electricity, the cold and the harsh conditions really contributed to the misery of people and the increase of infectious diseases, for instance. It was a really, really, really terrible crisis then.
Knowing what you know, Dr. Roseboom, about starvation's very long-term potential negative impacts, what can be done to mitigate them?
Well, I think it is really incredibly important to try, just like Oxfam and many others are trying to do, is to really make sure that people get access to food and get nutrition. But if that isn't possible, or if that isn't enough, what we have seen in the Dutch famine is that not everything is lost, in the sense that you can live with this more efficient metabolism, but people need to pay even more attention to their lifestyles, knowing how their bodies were programmed by the lack of food, and how their bodies respond differently to food. So it seems to be even more important for people who have been undernourished early in life to have a healthy lifestyle, to not eat too much, and to really make sure they exercise and rest to let their bodies recover.
Structurally, are you seeing anything that is making you feel like there is an awareness of this long-term effect, maybe from public leaders or recent policy decisions that you're seeing, Dr. Roseboom?
Well, I think in general, we still do not pay enough attention to the long-term consequences of undernutrition, and particularly for unborn generations. What we've learned from our studies is that unborn generations are unseen, unheard, and unprotected. And what we've learned from the studies in the Dutch famine is that these people carry the longest legacy of undernutrition. And I'm really afraid that, as I said before, the people in Gaza will carry this legacy with them for the rest of their lives, but particularly the unborn babies will carry the scars of war, really, in their physical, in their mental health, in their ability to participate to the labor market, to contribute to society. So it's both individual and societal damage that this will be causing for generations to come.
Abby, Oxfam has been operating in Yemen, for example, for more than 3 decades, as I understand it, another region that has faced unprecedented levels of hunger. What have we learned there? Are there strategies that Oxfam has found has made a dent across this sort of extended period of needing relief?
Well, I want to build on Tessa's comment on the both of these things, the intergenerational impacts of what people are experiencing with hunger and living through conflict and crisis. And Yemen is another example of that. It's in its 10th consecutive year of conflict, and communities have really been pushed to the brink. When I was there several years ago, it was, you can see also the inequality, where food is available on shelves, but those who need it didn't necessarily have access to it. And we know that this has deteriorated in recent years. And the number of households without enough to eat in Yemen has risen to 49% nationally. And these deteriorations are really anticipated to persist through the coming year. How we as Oxfam prioritize and try to deal with this certainly is looking for pathways to sustainable peace above all, which is so important for next generations, but also how we prioritize, be it in Yemen or in Gaza, targeting, making sure we are focusing on the most vulnerable, including pregnant and lactating mothers and children in any settings, but also the whole suite of things are needed beyond food. In Yemen, as in Gaza, we provide water and sanitation, cash, so that families have the ability to ensure that their basic needs are met, support for small food producers and businesses, and working with women. There's always a gendered component of this. Women are usually the ones who eat last and least, and we know that they're the ones, especially pregnant and lactating mothers, who need more. And so we need to make sure they're involved in how the work is planned and prioritized. And we see this whether we're in Sudan, South Sudan, Yemen, or Gaza. There's so much we know we can and should be doing, but often right now in the Gaza example and parts of other of these acute crises of conflict, being able to reach people safely without aid workers being killed. If you go to Gaza as one example, over 200 aid workers have been killed in the course of this crisis, and that too is unprecedented. So we really need the enabling environment holistically to do our jobs.
This is Nur on Discord, right? Seeing Israeli civilians attacking trucks and destroying food unopposed is yet another example of the pervasive indifference of the Israeli state to the suffering of Palestinians. Israel has intentionally produced these conditions in order to collectively punish and expel Palestinians by making life in their homeland unbearable. I wanted to actually get your reaction, Abby Maxman, to the news that the International Criminal Court is requesting essentially warrants for the leaders of Hamas, but also for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, on charges of war crimes, including crimes against humanity. And a New York Times explainer essentially was saying that Israel has denied causing the hunger crisis in Gaza or placing limits on humanitarian aid entering the territory, the UN and other organizations and have said that the UN and other organizations have failed to adequately distribute food and other humanitarian goods there. There is a real sense that the warrants requested are because of a belief that both Netanyahu and his defense minister bear responsibility for war crimes and crimes against humanity, including the starvation of civilians as a weapon of war. Do you think that there is some real substance to that based on what Oxfam has seen?
Well, we have been with our data and evidence on the ground sharing and the concerns about collective punishment and starvation being used as a weapon of war. We've been talking about that for some time. We also welcome any possibility of criminal accountability for Hamas or Israeli leaders, those who are responsible for obstruction and destruction and non-adherence to international humanitarian law and human rights law. We believe that more should be done, and the U.S. government holding the Israeli government accountable for ensuring humanitarian access and all of its commitments to enable to protect civilians and enable a meaningful, robust humanitarian response. And those conditions are not what we've been experiencing as an aid organization who's been working in Gaza and the occupied Palestinian territory and Israel since the 1950s.
Let me remind listeners, you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Well, Christina writes, check with your employer to see if they will match your donations to NGOs. I don't have a lot to donate, but I've been very lucky to work for employers that match my donations. When donations are down, this helps double the money I offer to WFP, World Central Kitchen, and other NGOs that are economically responsible and use that money to feed people. I assume Christina means the World Food Program. Another listener writes, my Dutch grandfather settled in Iowa in the early 1900s. By the time of World War II, he was the owner of a small grocery store. He and my mother shipped packages of food to relatives back in the Netherlands for a period of time. It is difficult to imagine how those parcels made it to their intended recipients and at what cost. We support World Central Kitchen today to hopefully achieve a better outcome. Abby, how can people help, especially here in California?
Thank you. There's so much that people can do. Of course, donating to organizations like Oxfam, for in our case, you can go to our website, www.oxfamamerica.org. But anything people can do, you can donate, you can take action, you can, we also have things on our website that help people know the messaging, what you can do to engage with your local members of Congress and elected officials so that you can encourage the administration of what they can do to do more and help turn the trajectory of this crisis. We need a ceasefire. We need a return of all hostages and a humanitarian access where our workers can work safely. And we need resources. The level of destruction and the level of need are both massive. And we are there. We are doing as much as we can under the circumstances with our partners, and everything is needed now: food, water, safe shelter, medical care, all of this and more. And we are on the ground ready, and we believe it's a political choice to let people in Gaza suffer and die from hunger and preventable disease. So people can take action, go to our website, and call their local elected officials to join the ceasefire campaign and other ways of being able to help turn this terrible trajectory and help people and save lives in Gaza now.
We have been talking about Gaza. We've been talking about Sudan, but there are also, and we've talked about Yemen, but I'm wondering, you know, where you feel like, Abby, the world has really looked away, the challenges, the headlines that we're seeing coming out of Haiti as well have been very disturbing. Just wondering if there are some places in acute hunger that you would really like to draw to our listeners' attention.
I'm glad you mentioned that, you know, because really, you know, as the world's gaze is on Gaza, understandably so. I was there several months ago in the region, and it's important that any crisis has the world's attention. But whether it's Haiti, Ukraine, there's no end in sight of this conflict, and huge numbers of people facing moderate or severe acute food insecurity. And Ukraine, as an example, had been a net food exporter. And so the implications on the global food supply chain are affected by these conflicts. We know across East Africa, Southern Africa, and the Sahel. So people, you know, everything you can do to support organizations like ours to be able to respond to what you are seeing in the news, but also respond in the places that are not in the public eye, where we are working. As Oxfam, we're working in 80 countries around the world, and everything you can do and everything we do to help those who aren't being in the spotlight at the moment, as well as in places like Gaza where we are, is invaluable.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Rosewood, I understand that the UN is preparing a declaration on future generations, essentially expressing our obligation to take care of the future, the generations who will come and try to mitigate the issues that we are facing now. Do you see any hope or recognition in that, in terms of efforts to try to understand the very long-term impacts of things like global hunger?
Absolutely. I think it's a very hopeful development that the United Nations are developing a declaration on future generations, realizing that the decisions we make today do not only affect people alive today, but also affect the generations to come. And based on the studies that we have been doing and many other scientists have been doing, that so clearly show that every living creature, but also human beings, are so incredibly sensitive to their environment, particularly during the earliest stages of development when we are unborn. We should really take into account the effects of all the decisions we make on the climate in which future generations will develop and will get the possibility to develop to their full potential. And currently, so many people's ability to develop to their full potential is limited because they're developing, living, growing up in environments with too little food, too little insecurity, too little access to basic healthcare needs. And this will impact their ability to develop to their full potential and have impacts on their own physical and mental health, as well as on their ability to contribute to society. So I'm very grateful that the United Nations are developing this declaration on future generations, and I really hope that we will live up to our obligations to future generations to create an environment in which future generations get the chance to develop to their full potential.
Well, Maya writes, my dad was 4 years old in the Netherlands during the Dutch famine. He has terrible memories of that time. I'm now wondering how that experience has been passed on to me and my two sons. Dr. Rosenblum, thank you for your research and for informing our understanding of the long-term effects of what is increasing in the world, and that is hunger. Thank you, Abby Maxman of Oxfam as well. Thank you, Francesca Fenzi, for this segment. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and